beginning with a verse that's actually quoted from the Purusha Sutta in the Rig Veda, and it shows up in the Yajur Veda also. Very famous verse. Sahasva Shirsha Purusha Sahasva Kshak Sahasva Pata Sabhumim Vishvato Vitva Atyatishta Doshangulam. The Purusha possesses thousands of heads, thousands of eyes, and thousands of feet. Breaking through the coverings of the material world, he rises to the height of his 10 thumbs. This last part of the third chapter is beginning to become more personal. It's not a fully Krishna conscious description the way we know it from the Bhagavatam, but the qualities of the Supreme Person being described in this and the following verses, when we study them, look at them, focus on them, they show to be very personal qualities. The qualities that he exhibits in reciprocating with his devotees. Although because the Upanishads in general are written for an impersonally inclined kind of audience, these personal descriptions are done in a low-key way, tactfully. You can understand them one way or another. So the impersonalists have their leeway to understand these descriptions in their way, impersonally. The Mayavadis are free to misinterpret them. But for the Vaishnavas, it's not hard to see the devotional aspect of what's being described. This Purusha Sukta is controversial, this whole prayer in the last chapter, 10th mandala of the Rig Veda. Because it seems to be such a theistic statement, many Western scholars just consider it to be a later edition and not part of the original Rig Veda. Or they give fanciful interpretations about the Purusha. Purusha means man. So this is the hymn to man, some humanistic, you know, description. Or a description of the original human sacrifice, cannibalistic sacrifice. Because in the Purusha Sutta it's described how the first sacrifice in the universe was performed. There was no paraphernalia available because Lord Brahma hadn't created anything yet. There was just the Purusha and the universal form. So out of the Purusha, they assembled, they collected the paraphernalia for the sacrifice. The body of God became the paraphernalia for the sacrifice. Anyway, the scholars can look at this and take it as a description of a human sacrifice, where they killed the victim, the human victim, and cut his body apart. Sacrifice that. We don't have to interpret it that way. Sahasra Shirsha Purusha. We already had description that he has many arms and legs. We discussed that before. Now we're going back to saying the same thing with the direct authority of the Rig Veda. We just read that he's the size of a thumb inside the heart, the size of the thumb of whatever living entity's heart he's sitting in. So when someone may doubt, therefore God is limited in size. But here, that's refuted. He's unlimited. He has thousands of heads, thousands of eyes and feet. And the word thousand is figurative for saying limitless. Nobody ever has 1,000 heads. So when you say someone has $1,000, lots of people nowadays have $1,000. But who has 1,000 heads? Saying that means countless number of heads. Okay. Not in this universe, though. We don't have experience. ten thumbs. It says he this is a little cryptic, that he pierced through the earth and stood up to the height of ten thumbs. This might be understood as the appearance of Garbhodakshaya Vishnu inside the universe. But he didn't stand up, he lied down. He lay down in the Garbhodak ocean. But he occupied half of the universe. He's sitting there now, Lord Garbhodakshaya Vishnu, occupying, basically, he's as big as the diameter of the whole universe. Dashambalam represents full height. In the Shilpa Shastra, which teaches you how to construct deities. The original Vedic science of sculpture. It's described how a human, ordinary human figure has nine heads and sides. You know, a mundane body. The dimension of the total body from top to bottom is nine, the equivalent of nine heads. But a divine form is ten heads. Yeah, that's a more perfect form. That's the complete size of a living being. Ten of his own heads. Oh, not heads. Well, it says head. I'm sorry, it says heads, but thumbs. This is the word here. I guess the thumb is about the size of a head. It says he pierced through the earth. That means that he envelops the entire universe. He pervades the entire universe. And he pierces through it means that he transcends it. Not only does he cover the whole universe with his energies, but he goes beyond it. He exists in the transcendental realm, the eternal, his own eternal kingdom. This is significant. Here we're describing that God is not only the creator of this world. He's not only existing for our benefit. He has his own existence beyond this world. A hint at the transcendental personality of the Lord. So, it says he has thousands of heads. It says he has thousands of eyes. Eyes? Why just eyes? That means he has thousands of eyes, but he only has two ears? No, he has... Eyes are mentioned, they represent all the knowledge-acquiring senses. Obviously, a person who has two eyes must have, or has 1,000 eyes, must have half as many. Usually, he has two eyes in each head, so he has half as many heads as he has eyes, and each head would have two ears and one nose, like that. So, he's got also countless other knowledge-acquiring senses. The eyes are mentioned, but they imply the other knowledge-acquiring senses. And the thousands of feet imply all the other active senses. We described before how this is one way the Lord appears as the universal form. But we can, it may be more congenial to the devotees to think of the Lord in his original personal form, not having so many thousands of heads. And understand that his having so many limbs is that he uses the senses and facilities of living entities for his service and for his carrying out the business of creating and maintaining the universe. He uses all the thousands of eyes, heads, legs of all the living entities, especially of the demigods who are his surrendered servants and do this work for him. Okay. The next verse is the next verse from the Purusha Sukta. This is the first verse, and then the second verse from the Purusha Sukta is the next verse, 3:15.
Purusha evedam sarvam yat bhutam yat bhavyam utamitatvasyeshano yat adninati rohati.
The Purusha is everything in this world, both past and future. He is everything that grows by food. He is the Lord of immortality. So, Even more clearly, here it describes that the Lord is not only the creator of this world. He transcends it. And there's a beginning here of the description of his transcendental personal existence. Some hint of it, at least. He's everything in this world. He's everything. But we understand he's transcendentally everything. He transcends the phases of time. God's existence is not like the existence of everything else in this world, which is limited by time. Everything has a past, a present, and a future, which means everything material at one time in the past didn't exist, and in one time in the future will not exist. In other words, everything material is temporary and limited by time. Whereas the Supreme Person's existence, even in the material world, is unlimited by time. Whatever he is what he always was and always will be, even as he appears. And everything that ever did exist in this world, and everything that ever will exist, comes from him and no other source, is controlled completely by him, and he's completely aware of it. He knows completely the past, present, and future. He's not existing in the mundane realm, even when he's in it. Of course, a surrendered, liberated soul in this world also. He's not like God pervading everything. He can't create the world, but he has also this perfect consciousness. He can understand past, he can be conscious of past, present, and future all at once, the liberated soul. To his own limited capacity, he doesn't know everything, but he's not limited by time in his realization. He's living on the eternal realm, the liberated soul. Whereas Rupa Goswami says that the sun, udyan astam chayanasa viteyat kshano nito uttama shloka lilaya, the sun rising and setting every day is marking the waste of another day of every person's life, except for those who are fully engaged in Krishna consciousness, hearing and chanting Krishna's glories. For them, time is not taking away their life. They're not affected by the passing of time. This verse from the Purusha Sukta is echoed in the Bhagavatam, where the Purusha himself, Lord Garbhadakshaya Vishnu, who is the subject of the Purusha Sukta prayer, Purusha Sukta is glorifying and describing Garbhadakshaya Vishnu. Garbhadakshaya Vishnu describes himself in his instructions to Lord Brahma in the 9th chapter of the 2nd canto. In four verses, he explains himself. And so there's a parallel verse in the four-verse Bhagavatam spoken by Garbhadakshaya Vishnu. This verse written here on page 57. Aham eva asam eva gre nan yad yad sadasat param paschad aham yad etat cha yova shishyeta sosmyaham. Brahma, it is I, the personality of Godhead, who was existing before the creation, when there was nothing but myself. Nor was the material nature the cause of this creation. That which you see now is also I, the personality of Godhead. And after annihilation, what remains will also be I, the personality of Godhead. Or just as it said here in this verse, the Purusha is everything. What was in the past, what will be in the future. The commentator explains the word cha, and in this second line, although only the past and the future are mentioned specifically, the word and implies the present also. He is the Lord of immortality, of the immortal world, the spiritual world. He's also the Lord of the material world. Yad anin atirohati. Everything that grows by food. Well, in the spiritual world, nothing grows by food. Nobody has to eat in the spiritual world. And if somebody grows, it's because they want to grow, not because they ate some food. But in the material world, you don't exist without food. You know, even the plants have to make some food for themselves by photosynthesis, and that's how they live. And if you're not a plant, you have to eat somebody else. That's how you can live in this world, in the material world. That's a different one way to define the difference between the material world and the spiritual world. Material world is where you have to live, you have to eat. So he's also the Lord of everything that grows by food. So sometimes in the Upanishads, the word anam means the material world. Food, that's one poetic way of describing the material way. Is that where, and then the sage in the Taittiriya Upanishad, at the very end, he's reciting an ecstatic prayer where he's realizing, aham anam, I am food. Yeah. In other words, my material body is just a material body, and it's food for somebody else. And the higher understanding is that I am meant for the enjoyment of the Supreme Person. But anam is poetically the characterization of the material world. It's food. And it's everything that lives by eating food. The Purusha is the Lord of both. The Amrita, the eternal Amrita, the eternal nectar of the spiritual world, and the perverted, limited nectar of what's enjoyed, what's lived by eating food in the material world. Okay. 16. Okay, there's another verse that's an echo of some other source. Passport. Thank you very much, Prabhu. Thank you. My passport. Oh, I wanted to read one more echo from the Bhagavatam to this second verse in the Purusha Sutta. From the chapter, in the second chapter, chapter 6, which has the title, the Prabhupada gave it the title, the Purusha Sutta Explained. Because those verses in that chapter spoken by Lord Brahma, I think, to Narada, are a commentary on the verses of the Purusha Sutta. And here there's two verses, 2:18 and 19. Somritasya bayasyesho martyam annam yad atyagad mahimaisha tato brahman purushasya duratyayaha. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is the controller of immortality and fearlessness, and he is transcendental to death and the fruitive activities of the material world. O Narada, O Brahmana, it is therefore difficult to measure the glories of the Supreme Person. The second verse really doesn't fit here. That's a commentary on the next verse of the Purusha Sukta, which is not quoted here. So I won't read that. Now, we'll go on to verse 16. Sarvatakpani panam tat, padam tat, sarvatakshi shiro mukham, sarvatakshuti malloke sarvama vityatishtati. Everywhere are his hands and feet, everywhere his eyes, heads, mouths, and ears. He is present everywhere, pervading the entire universe. This is exactly the same as a verse in the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 13, verse 14, spoken by Krishna. So here we're echoing both backwards and forwards. There's a quote from the Rig Veda, and there's a verse that's quoted in the Bhagavad Gita, one after another, and they both have basically the same meaning. We can consider Bhagavad Gita the last Shruti. It's sometimes called an Upanishad, but it was spoken by Krishna only 5,000 years ago. And the Rig Veda is supposed to be the first Shruti. And they're both echoed. They both meet their echo right here toward the end of the middle, about the middle of the Shvetashvatara Upanishad. The Lord pervades everything by having expansion of hands, legs, other limbs everywhere. And the way it's described in this verse, each of his limbs is present everywhere. Of course, we know from the Brahma Samhita, all his limbs can perform the functions of every other. He can see, hear, grab something from one end of the universe without moving. He can extend his limbs anywhere by his mystic power. In a sense, we can say that the liberated soul also becomes like this. Not that he has the same infinite power that God has, Not that he has no limit on his power, the liberated jiva. But he's free. And his senses also become transcendental. Within his own limits, he's no longer limited, he's no longer constrained by material limits. It's not that he can only see with his eyes. It's not that he has to be physically present in one place to have some influence there. Just like we worship the spiritual master, he may not be physically present on the planet, but we consider in his murti, in his name, in his picture, he's present. And he's present in the sense that he has the same personal influence as if he was physically there. So a transcendental personality has that power to extend his influence beyond the ordinary limitations of the senses of the body. Okay, then there is here some short description from the Vedanta Sutra. Third chapter of the Vedanta Sutra, part 3, verses 66, Sutra 66 and 67. So the first sutra says, Guna sadaranya sutescha. Translation of that. And, the quote of the sutra says, and in connection with any limb of the Lord, one can meditate on any other limb's qualities. Because of the statement of Shruti about the universality of his qualities. In other words, somebody is suggesting, just for the sake of argument, that because his limbs all have infinite power, they're not limited, they all have universal power, you can think, you can meditate on his arms and think of his arms as having the qualities that his feet have. Or, you know, look at his feet and conceive of it having the same beautiful features that his head has. But Vyasadeva says, or first of all, commenting on this, Baladeva Vibhushan says, from the statement, Sarvatak Pani Padam, from the Shvetashvatara Upanishad and Bhagavad Gita, that he has his legs and other limbs everywhere, it's suggested that since it seems to be said that the same qualities are found in all of his limbs indiscriminately, then you could focus on any of the Lord's personal features, any of his limbs, and think about any of the qualities of any of the limbs without making any distinctions. That, according to Baladeva Vidyabhushan, is refuted in the following sutra. The answer to that is in the next sutra. Na va tat saha bhava shrute. No. Because there are no shruti statements about the combination of limbs with other limbs' qualities. A commentary on that, Baladeva Vidyabhushan. We shouldn't think that we can just mix up the qualities belonging to any of the limbs. Why? Because there aren't such statements saying that we can combine qualities one limb with another limb. When we hear a description, when we read in the scripture a description of the qualities of one of the Lord's limbs, we don't hear that that quality is also found in his other limbs. The same, you know, the quality of his head is not also present in his feet. His feet don't serve his head, don't look like his head. So we shouldn't think like that. Rather, we should meditate on each limb of the Lord in its own proper way, according to its own special qualities. And when we read a statement like, he has his arms, his legs everywhere his eyes, his heads, that should be understood that everywhere his energies are present. Not that he has his feet on top of his head, and vice versa. That means that his personal potencies extend everywhere. That's what it's supposed to mean. Okay, verse 17.
Sarvendriya Gunabhasam Sarvendriya Vivarjitam Sarvasya Prabhur Ishanam Sarvasya Sharanam Surit.
He inspires the functions of everyone's senses, but he has no material senses himself. He is the personal master and controller of all beings, their shelter and their well-wishing friend. That's pretty personal. It's describing him not only the controller of every, he's already been described as a controller of everything. So by logical extension, of course, he's also the controller of every living being. But that means, as explained here, that he's personally the shelter of every living being. Our real shelter is not to be found anywhere in the material energy. The essence of the process of devotional service is to stop taking shelter of Maya and take shelter of Krishna and his devotees. If you can do that, you're successful in devotional service, even if you do nothing else. That's called prapatti, sharanapati, sharanagati. It's taking complete shelter of the Lord and of the Vaishnavas. So that's what's being described here. He's everybody's shelter. And beyond that, he's everyone's well-wishing friend. Just like, yes, you have to surrender to the Lord. He's your shelter. But we have to understand what surrendering is. It's not like someone who's being chased by the police and they're chasing him in the police car and his car finally runs out of gas. He jumps out of the car, runs up against the wall, and they've got the gun pulled on him. He finally says, okay, I surrender. This is not the kind of surrender to be described here. And then you're in custody. You're under the shelter of the police. You know, it's not that kind of surrender, not that kind of shelter. Because Krishna is not just the transcendental police. He is. But beyond that, he's everybody's well-wishing best friend. He means for everybody to be happy and have all his desires fulfilled. That's about as personal as you can get. In the context of this Upanishad, Shravetashvatara Rishi could not get away with being more explicit about the process of devotional service. I'm not going to mention Krishna by name, but he is describing the personal qualities of the Supreme. He's everybody, he's not only the Lord and controller of everything, but he's everybody's ultimate shelter and everybody's most well-wishing friend, Surit. Hardly anybody understands that about God. Everybody knows that God is the Lord to be feared. But who understands, beside the Vaishnavas, that he's your best friend? Everybody's best friend. Some people think God is our friend, and he's going to help us destroy our enemies. He's our friend and our enemy's enemy. But Vaishnavas understand he's everybody's well-wishing friend.
Oh, this is 17.
He has no material senses. Sarvendriya guna vivarjitam. But, he's the transcendental object, ultimately to be perceived by everybody's senses, by the knowledge acquiring senses, by the eyes, ears. He's the original object. That's what our eyes and ears ultimately exist for. To find and experience the Supreme Person. And our active senses also are meant for achieving him. And he's revealed to the senses. God can be known. He can be realized. He's not unknowable. Of course, this is also half of this verse is from the Bhagavad Gita, and the very next verse, 13-15 from the Bhagavad Gita, is the first two lines of that are the same as the first two lines here. Second two lines are different. He has no material senses, but he can maintain contact with the senses of all the jivas by his inconceivable energy. This is describing him as a transcendental person. This is the concept of Bhagawan. This is not just Super Soul. The secret of understanding Bhagawan, the Supreme Person, God as a person, is the mysterious idea that the transcendental person is a different kind of person. Every ordinary person is limited by having senses, by having a body. That makes us material, that makes us prone to suffering, birth and death. But God can have a body, he can have activities and a personality without being limited, without being degraded. So that those who are theists, but their theism is impersonal, they can't allow God to have a body and a personality. He has to remain formless, or at least he has no face and no activities. God is sitting on his throne. You know, he has a white beard, but there's no face there. And he never gets out of his throne and does anything. He's too old for that. They can't understand that God can do anything or have any personality of his own and still be perfect. That's the mystery. And that mystery of devotion, the mystery of the idea of Bhagawan is being described in this verse. Very similar to the description of Bhagavad Gita. Okay, 7:18.
Navadware pure dehi hangsole layate bahihi vashi sarvasya lokasya stavarasya charasya cha.
The swan-like Lord dwells in the city of nine gates, sharing the finite soul's body. He also moves outside the conditioned soul's body, engaging in his own pastimes. He rules the entire world, everything moving and non-moving. This phrase, this living in this, the idea of living in the city of nine gates, and these words, Navadvare Pare, are also echoed in the Bhagavad Gita. It says a living entity in the Bhagavad Gita, but we're talking about the living entity and the Supreme Soul living in the same body, both sharing this city of nine gates.
The real controller of all the worlds, Vashi.
Vasha means control. Vashi is the person who has control. He's the controller of all the worlds. Nobody else is. Even the Super Soul is just his expansion. Super Soul has limited functions. The Super Soul is individually present in everybody's heart. But the personality of Godhead, with all his potencies, he's the actual complete controller of everything, spiritual and material. Super Soul is not present in the spiritual world. So that person who is the controller of all the worlds, not just the material worlds, but the spiritual worlds too, that is only a description of the personality of Godhead. This word leilayate can be understood as closely related to the word lila. That's why I translate it as he's engaging in his own pastimes, because the verb is the same verb from the word that the word lila comes from. Sports. He sports. Inside the body of the living entity, the living entity is not having lilas. It would be audacious for him to say that his conditioned life is his lila. He's suffering. He's out of control. He's being punished in his material condition. That's not his lila. But the Lord is not being punished. He's not suffering. He's enjoying his lila no matter where he is, even sitting inside our body with us. He's also enjoying still. And then outside the body also, in his own realm, he's continuing to enjoy his pastimes. He's the controller of all
the worlds, and of all the inhabitants of all the worlds, the moving beings, including physical elements, and the plants, and the non-moving beings, and the moving beings, the animals, human beings, and demigods. The nine gates of the body are the two eyes, the two nostrils, the two ears, and the mouth. That makes seven gates that are found in the head. And then there are two gates at the bottom, the anus and the genital. And these are exits. Things enter and leave the body through these nine gates. The living entity sometimes goes out of his body to try to find sense gratification. In the sense that he looks out of his eyes and he extends his arms and tries to get some sense gratification. He's looking outward and extending himself outward, attempting to get enjoyment from external objects. The Lord is not. He's sitting in the heart, tolerating all this nonsense and trying to give guidance to the living entity. That we'll see later on in the description of the two birds in the same tree. That verse is here. In the fourth chapter. Okay, we do verse 19. Any questions on all this?
Who's quoting the verse of the fool? Bhagavad Gita is quoting the
You can say that if you want. You can assign a chronology. You know, Bhagavad Gita is supposed to be more recent. Bhagavad Gita is spoken by Krishna at the beginning of Kali Yuga. But we can understand our basic viewpoint that this whole body of literature is eternal and it's one organism. You know, if I step on a nail and the nerve of my foot is affected by that nail going through my foot, I feel pain in my head. So where's the pain really? Is it in my foot or in my head? My consciousness pervades the whole body. It's really, you can't answer the question. It's both places. You know, where's the real pain? In the foot or the head? And I can ask, well, which one is echoing which one? But it goes back and forth. It's one organ. My body is one organism. And the nerve, electricity going through the nerves circulates. You know, the agitation of the nerve in the foot goes to the brain, and then the brain sends information back to the foot, and it goes back and forth. So like that, when you have an echo, it's bouncing back and forth. There's an integral connection between the Rig Veda on one side, the Upanishads in the middle, and the Gita and the Puranas on the other side. It's all these echoes are bouncing back and forth. It's in the ultimate sense, we can't. There's no answer to which one comes first. They're all existing simultaneously. They're eternal literatures, ultimately. But they take different roles. One of them appears as coming, as being younger than another one. That's just external appearance. Okay, 19. This is a verse that Prabhupada liked to quote. Apani paro javano grahita pasyatya chakshu sashrinotya karnaha saveti vedyam nachatasyasti veta tam ayur ahur agriyam purusham mahantam. Without hands or feet, he swiftly seizes everything in his path. He sees without eyes, and he hears without ears. He knows whatever is to be known, but no one knows him. Therefore, he is called the original Supreme Person. This phrase at the very end, Purusha Mahantam, was those two words were spoken back at the eighth verse of this chapter. Vedaham etam Purusha Mahantam, I know this Supreme Person.
And now it says they, the sages, or those who know, call him the original Supreme Person. Reiteration. Even without having material senses, he can carry out all the functions of the senses. He has his inconceivable divine energies, and he can work in transcendental ways. Therefore, for that reason, everybody should meditate on him, worship him, because nobody else has this qualification. He doesn't have any material active senses, like feet and hands. Still, he can do the work of the feet. He can move wherever he wants to go. That's what people use their feet for, to move from one place to another. He can do the work of the hands without having any material hands. He can take anything he wants. Just reach out and take it without having any material hands. Or the word grahita, which we're translating as meaning he can seize everything. It means seizer, the person who can seize. It can mean that he's the upholder, the maintainer, and the executor of creation, maintenance, and annihilation. Then he also doesn't have any knowledge-acquiring senses, like eyes and ears. It says he has no eyes, no ears. Still, he perceives everything. He sees without eyes. He hears without ears, without material eyes and material ears. Even without material instruments of hearing, he hears everything, including the prayers of his devotees. And he has full function of the internal sense, the mind. That means, it says he knows everything. That means, without having a material mind, he performs the functions of the mind. He knows everything. And then the mystery is, he knows everything, but nobody knows him. Which means that no material person can know him. No ordinary person can know him at all. Can properly understand anything about the personality of God. And nobody, not even his pure devotees, know him completely. In that sense, in those two senses, he's not knowable. Not knowable at all by the unqualified person, and not completely knowable even by the most qualified person. Okay, what was 16? Yeah, well, that's a mystery. He's got his hands and his legs everywhere, and now he doesn't have any. Well, we know it's not described explicitly here. We know he has his eyes, Krishna. We see a picture of Krishna, he has some eyes. He has two hands, he has two legs. Because he has spiritual eyes and hands. Although that's not being described. Personality of God with his transcendental eyes and hands is not being described in this book. So in this book, we can understand it in a different way. As the commentators explain 16, that all these thousands of hands and legs that he has are the hands and legs of the living entities, especially the demigods who helped him create the world and maintain it. Yeah. Anyway, we have to understand, he has no legs mean he has no material legs. No material hands. He's got some hands and legs, but they're not material. You're supposed to read these two verses and say, wait a minute, what is this supposed to mean? And think about it. Okay, two more verses and we'll finish this chapter. Oh, but one thing, 19. We can read here from Chaitanya Charitamrita Madhyalila, chapter 6. This is a nice reference because it shows how Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, in his preaching at the top of 61, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu referred to this particular verse of the Shvetashvatara Upanishad in his own preaching. It starts at the very bottom of 60. Apani pada shruti varje prakrita pani chorona puna kohe shigra chole kore sova grohom. The Vedic Apani pada mantra, that's this verse, rejects material hands and legs, yet it states that the Lord goes very fast and accepts everything offered to him. Oto eva shuti kohe brahma savisesho mukya chadi lokana te mane nirvisesho. All these mantras confirm that the absolute truth is personal, but the Mayavadis, throwing away the direct meaning, interpret the absolute truth as impersonal. So that's Chaitanya Mahaprabhu quoting and preaching from the Shvetashvatara Upanishad. At verse 20, another famous verse that Prabhupada quoted often. It's not found only in this Upanishad, it also shows up in the Katha Upanishad and a few other Upanishads. Anur aniyan mahato mahiyan atma guhayam nihitosya jantoho tamakratum pasyati vita shoko datu prasadan mahimanam isham. He is smaller than the smallest and greater than the greatest, with no desire of his own for enjoyment in this world. He lives in the heart of every embodied creature. By the mercy of that creator of all, one who has given up lamentation can perceive him and his glory. So, again, not only in two different verses, but here in one verse, contradictory qualities are being postulated. Openly, in one verse. He's bigger than the biggest and smaller than the smallest also. Well, this means various things. He's capable of entering all the most subtle things, including the heart of a living entity, because he's smaller than the smallest. And he's also infinitely large. As smaller than the smallest, he's the soul of the soul. He's the super soul. And he sits inside the heart of the jiva. This is hard to understand. Looks like a complete contradiction. But it says, Tama kvatum pashyati. One can see and understand him. He can be understood. He can be seen directly. Datu prasada. By the mercy of him, this is the creator and supreme controller. By his mercy, someone can understand him and can see him directly and see his glory. Mahima means glory. We can understand that means you can see God and you can see his spiritual energy with him. That's an illusion. The supreme personality of Godhead, along with his internal potency, his pleasure potency, hinted at by the word Mahima, God and his glory. The jiva is very small. It is almost impossible to see the jiva. But yogis, by the special power of perception that is the potential of the mind has the potential to see the jiva. Not easy. Not everybody can, but a yogi can. But ordinary yogis can't perceive the supersoul. He's more inaccessible, more subtle than the jiva. He's bigger than the ether, which is the biggest thing in the material world, because he pervades the ether. The ether is contained inside him. Yes. Yes, but that's not his real size. He just appears in that size. It's like the sun reflected in a certain size body of water. It takes the size of what it's reflected in. Supersoul like that, Supersoul doesn't actually change his size. He's one person. He's the same everywhere. But he seems reflected in different sizes. But he's said to be smaller than the jiva in the sense that he's so subtle he can enter the jiva, and that he's harder to see than the jiva. Jiva is hard to find because he's very small. The supersoul is harder to find than the jiva, not because he's even smaller, really, literally, because he's not seeable at all by any material perception. But we figuratively say that he's even smaller, meaning that he's even harder to see. Okay. You can't put a size on something that's not material, ultimately. He doesn't have any size. He doesn't fit any material measurement.
With his
Well, as described here, one way to understand it, a few ways to understand it, that he's more subtle than the jiva. He can enter the jiva. He can enter everything. In order to enter something very small, you have to become even smaller than it. And he enters everything. That's okay. How is that understood? That's understood simply that he reciprocates with every living entity. He appears as the personal guide of every living entity. And in order to be able to reciprocate with the living entity, he appears in the right, exactly suitable size. Just like if Krishna wants to come and be your friend, or just like Lord Balaram married the daughter of Revata, but she was from the previous age when people were a lot taller. She was 80 feet tall. And Lord Balaram didn't like the idea of having a wife that was a few times taller than him. So he took his plow and he pulled her down to a reasonable size. So the super soul, he makes himself a suitable size to reciprocate with each living entity. He appears in a different size for each living entity. And an elephant, appears the size of an elephant thumb. An ant, he appears the size of the ant thumb. But that's just appearance. It's like a television program. It's like a television program. You have a little tiny Sony 2-inch TV. The people, the characters in the TV program look like they're 1 centimeter tall. If you have a 29-inch TV, they look a lot bigger, but the television program is no different. It's an image only, reflected image. Okay. Everybody thinks they've got reality emanating from their television set, and therefore they spend half of their life sitting in front of the television, and they think that's reality, but it's not. It's just an image. And the super soul is not the ultimate reality, it's just a reflection. Of the personality of Godhead. But the personality of Godhead not displaying himself fully and not showing his personality. The most important part of him he's not showing. Where you find the real satisfaction in life is in the personal reciprocation. And that's not found in relationship with the super soul. His glory is there, his controlling power and even his beauty are manifest. But his personality is not. His active personality is not manifest in his form as a super soul. Okay, did we read 20? Yeah, okay. I will read 21. Oh, yeah, just one last thing. He said Vita Shoha. So, the Lord is Akvatu. The Lord, Akvatu means inactive. Of course, Krishna has his activities, but he doesn't have any material activity. He's not obligated to go to work and earn some money. He doesn't have any material obligations, and he doesn't perform any material activity. So he's akvatu, inactive. And the living entity who sees him by the Lord's mercy becomes vita-shoka, free from all sorrow. That's been stated before in different words here. This is an idea that's repeated over and over again. Those who realize him become free from distress. Okay, last verse in the chapter. A repetition of this phrase, Vedaham, that was in verse 8, Vedaham etam purusham mahantam. Those first two words are repeated here. The last two words, or the other two words, purusham mahantam, were at the end of verse 19, I think? Yeah, purusham mahantam. And now the first two words of that 8th verse, Vedaham, are repeated here in the last verse of the chapter. Vedaham etam ajaram puranam sarvatmanam sarvagatam vibhutvat janma nirodham pavaranti yasya brahmavadi nohi pavaranti nityam. I know this soul of all beings, the most ancient of all, who never grows old. By virtue of his infinite size, he is always present everywhere. Authorities on the Absolute describe his birth and passing away, but they also describe him as eternal. Okay, this is a very personal description. Of course, it says he never grows old, and he's the oldest person. Another conjunction of contradictory qualities. Only God can have all these contradictory qualities and reconcile all of them. He's the oldest, and still he never gets old. And he's the soul of everybody and is found everywhere because he's all-pervasive. Now here it's said in the last two lines, the sages, those who are authorities about Brahman, they say that he has his birth and death. But they also say that he's eternal. Another apparent contradiction. But the secret meaning here, the confidential meaning, that may not be understood by the impersonalists who read this Upanishad, that he has his transcendental birth and activities, his pastimes. This is a hint, a fairly obvious hint, but it could be ignored by the impersonalists if they want to, that the Lord has his transcendental pastimes, his lila, his birth and which involve his birth and his disappearance from this world. And this birth and activity are described by great sages. You don't have to become a mystic yogi to have some realization of Krishna's birth and activities and his passing away, because great sages like Vyasadeva have described these birth and activities in books like Srimad Bhagavatam. So this is almost an advertisement for the Bhagavatam here in the Upanishad. That's about as personal as we can get, without violating the limitations of what you're supposed to say in an Upanishad. There's a few points here from the commentaries. I pretty much said everything already. Although he's the oldest, he's also ever young, eternal. Why doesn't everybody know him then, if he has all these amazing qualities? And he is noble, but he's hidden in the heart. He doesn't reveal himself to just anyone. To those who are envious of him, or not interested in him because they're too absorbed in illusion, he doesn't reveal himself. He's only found by a devoted search. By searching with diligence and devotion. Then you can find him. Okay, we can stop here. Are there any questions? Okay. Thank you all. Shiva Prabhupada.